One of these is Shelley Versus, masseuse, spiritual counselor, and den mother for the 7-Eleven team who shops daily to feed her hungry riders. Shelley is called a soigneur, from the French word meaning to aid.
All right, what's next?
I gotta get juices for the guys for before and after the race.
More liquid? You got already enough stuff in here for an army to cross the desert.
Food for breakfast and for after the race. They like these nectars.
How much do they really drink during the day if they're racing?
During the race, the guys drink sometimes 3 to 5 liters of liquid. Their energy drink, their water.
3 to 5 liters is...
pretty much.
That's like what I drink in a week.
Yeah. Unless you drink a lot of beer.
This is part two of a three-part series for Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast. It's called Chapter and Verses, with me, Lionel Burney, in conversation with Shelley Versus, who became the first woman to work as a soigneur at the Tour de France in 1986. She was with the 7-Eleven team, who were themselves a novelty on the race, the first American team to ride the Tour, and they were a breath of fresh air, bringing some much-needed modernity to a race that was steeped in history and tradition. Shelley's presence on the race also attracted a lot of media attention. This is 1986, the first time an American team has gone to the Tour de France. You know, the Tour, this traditional French race, was opening its doors, wasn't it? It was welcoming in people from different parts of the world, different cultures, and slowly it was beginning to change. But I guess at the start, it was quite a culture shock for them as well. But didn't they have to change the rules to more or less allow you to work in like the feed zone, for example, at the Tour de France?
I don't even know what they were thinking. Jacques Godet was the was a real sweetheart to me. He told me I was very courageous. when no one was looking. At the start, when I would go to collect the Coca-Cola bidons, every soigneur at the start would go and get the bidons from like this big podium. You had to use Coca-Cola musettes and bidons. And sometimes he would come up to me and, you know, give me 2 kisses. And when he was doing that, he would tell me how courageous I was. And I didn't really know what all that meant. I think he was trying to tell me that I was brave. And I was trying to get through the day, just get through the morning. And they were, I don't think they had a choice because they had already let us in the Tour. And 2 soigneurs were to do the feed. And so, you know, Leviton let the team in just the month before. Our guys never saw what those roads look like. They didn't get to do reconnaissance training. We did Tour of the Redlands. We did Tour of Baja. And, you know, wow. Jeff Pierce he turned pro for the race. That was his first pro race. That, you know, it was so, we're like this little mishmash crew. But that's kind of our story. We didn't ride that time trial before. We didn't, you know, System U and all those guys, they like would go drive the course and ride the course. Our guys didn't ride the course. We didn't know to, you know.
And yet the team ended up with the yellow jersey at the end of stage one.
I know.
At the line, 3 of Steeda's pursuers finished before him. And although the Canadian was denied a win in the day's race, finishing 5th, he had done something far more damaging. Steeda had completed a good day's work while out on his breakaway ahead of the pack. Being first through all those sprints earned him valuable time bonuses. And as the rest of the pack crossed the line pretty much together, Steeda became the man of the hour. And it's clear by this picture that Steeda was not yet aware of what he had done. The Canadian was now leading the Tour de France.
I mean, talk about Hollywood, a little bit of Hollywood in the Tour de France. I mean, an incredible story. What do you remember about that?
I remember standing, you know, I wish people today got to see more of what the podium used to look like back then in the years to follow. It was a truck, Lionel. Lionel, it was a truck. It was a flatbed truck. And like the president of France would be there. In years to follow, the president of France would be up there, putting the jersey on the guys sometimes. And the guys would go up on a flatbed and they would put the jerseys on them. And I remember standing there, and Link was up there getting one jersey, two jerseys, three jerseys, all the jerseys put on. And I'm like, what are all those jerseys? And what's with the stuffed animal? Okay, like, what's that lion? And it was so crazy. I didn't even know what those jerseys were for. And Oach went up there, and I was so ecstatic because the other soigneur was speaking in Dutch to me, like he has alles, the tricos. And I'm like, all the tricos, all the jerseys. And I'm like, oh no, this is just the biggest thing. And I got really excited when I heard him say alles, all the tricos. And I thought, this is a big day.
And the rider you're talking about, Link, is was that his nickname?
Yeah, Link, like the missing link, the Alex Steeda. And he wanted his hair to be dyed. These guys wanted me to start cutting their hair. I didn't know how to dye hair, but that was something that started that couple of days before the tour, the day before, okay? But they started asking me to cut their hair at the Giro because their hair was coming in their face from the hairnet helmet. And I refused to cut their hair. But then Mike Neal said, cut their hair. You just do what they say. Don't argue. Just calmly cut their hair. And so I didn't know how to cut hair. So it got real crazy because it would get shorter on one side, longer on the other. So, of course, Link was the first one that wanted his hair cut. Then Gomer wanted his hair cut. Then Jock wanted his hair cut. Then guys on Fagor wanted their hair cut. Then Paul Coakley wanted his hair cut. I cut Paul Coakley's hair for like, all the years he was on the circuit, and he was bald. Okay.
I was going to say, yeah,
Oh, I thought.
wow. So apart from the haircutting, Shelley, what were the main jobs that you had to do as a soigneur in the 7-Eleven team at that time, 1986? What was the job involving?
Well, we woke the riders up and we woke up the staff and we collected the baggage and we put the baggage in the trucks. And, there was like 70 pieces of baggage. And my team was slightly different because we didn't have those valises. We didn't have those suitcases that all the other teams had. And so the soigneurs on my team never saw this. We had big, huffy duffel bags, like ice hockey duffel bags. And the other soigneurs on the other teams were making fun of our duffel bags, but I didn't know anything different because Huffy, our bike company, made these bags for us. But these bags held like twice as much weight. And so our European soigneurs, Etienne Illegems, this guy who had so much experience, this elegant soigneur, and Mark Verruya, they were so experienced. And so all the soigneurs like Barbu, like Michel de Kock, he had worked for, all the European teams. These guys were all going, what's that? Like a body bag? And where's your valises? And so our soigneurs were like, why don't we have valises? And I'm like, what's that? And a valise. And they're like, why don't we have suitcases lined up? Like, dak, 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 dak. I go, I don't know. I've never seen that before. So these bags are too heavy. They need to be emptied out, they were telling us. And so I'm not going to carry these heavy bags. And that was a big thing, was they refused to carry two of my boys' bags, three of them, actually. I said, I'll carry those bags. And the reason why Eric Heiden's bag was extra heavy was because he had medical books in there because he was studying to be a doctor. Bob Roll and Alcala's bags were heavy because they had speakers in there because they like to listen to music. Okay. So there was that. So we had to carry bags. And we made the food, we made the riders' food for the race, before the race, of course, during the race. We made post-race food, muesli. We washed their clothes. Okay. So the riders were supposed to wash their clothes in the sink. All right. Some of them would forget. And so
Right, yeah.
we could go on about Bob Roll for 20 years, Bob Roll stories, but we're going to waste our time today if we do that. So, and then we massaged them pre race, after the race. We made the sandwiches for the invitees and for the staff. And we made sure that the guys were always calm. You know, they got panicky. We worked with our team doctor, Massimo Testa, and we did wound care if the guys crashed. And so we, as the race went on, you know, guys started not feeling well, you know, and they got sick. So we only had one team doctor. Today, there's like a whole camping car full of doctors. So it was a lot of different kind of work.
A lot of work and a lot of hard work, I guess. Long days,
Yeah.
right?
Yes. So some days I would fall asleep on my massage table. I'd forget to bring my table down. So I like in the Alps or the Pyrenees, you know, we wore our vests, our, you know, our down vests. Because it was cold or snow up there. And at night, at the end of the evening or at nightfall, I'd close up my table, my massage table, to bring it down and put it in the truck. So it was, I wouldn't have to do it in the morning. And I'd go, oh, I just want to stretch my back. And I'd lie down on the table just to stretch my back. And I had this little watch that had time zones and stuff. I had an alarm on there. All of a sudden, I hear beep, 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 beep. Beep, 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 beep. I'm like, what's that? And I'd wake up and I would be flat out on the table, not ever having gotten into the bed. And I'd still have my down vest on and my wool hat. And I would be so upset. And apparently this was the thing. Some other massage therapists, some other soigneurs would have done the same thing, but they'd never talk about it. But I was like, talky talk, talk. Okay. Then I would like, instead of leaving the same clothes on, I'd strip, shower, change, and go down. And then I'd tell everybody about it. And they'd go, oh, Shalia, di passa, you know, don't say that. It shows your weakness. I'm like, oh, so what else is new? I
Amazing,
know.
amazing. But what really stands out from that 86 tour, the first time you went to the Tour de France?
Greg LeMond and Bernardino.
Yeah.
Jeez, that was just like the most legendary tour up to that point in the history of the Tour de France. Okay. Here was my hero. Here was Greg LeMond, all of our hero, having this epic battle of the Titans with Bernardino. And we were trying to survive every single day in the tour. And then suddenly, pretty quickly, the tour that was promised to our friend by Eno, who had won five, and said, who had said to Greg, I'm going to help you this year, turns on him. And, you know, in private, I had gone to Mike Neal, my director, asking him, how do I behave when Greg comes over so panicky every night to our hotel? And Andy Hampson, you know, kind of tries to sneak away and comes to our hotel to see our boys. And he goes, you stay like a Swiss person. You stay like Switzerland. like a neutral ground to everybody, to Greg, to Steve Bauer, to Andy Hampson, and to all the riders, especially the riders on the table, and that everything is fine and everything's going to be okay. But the riders were like, how do we help Greg? What do we do? Everyone was panicky, especially Greg. And Greg was really panicky. And so I just thought, I have never seen anything, nor will I ever see anything like this again until anarchy came in the tour, you know? When that was like a whole other tour, but this was something so unreal. You couldn't even make it up. It was like a thriller. And Greg was rattled. He was so rattled. But there was something inside of him that his fortitude was larger than life. He was such a gifted athlete that I was telling my boyfriend this morning that as an amateur, his engine was so big that if he was training or racing with any of my 7-Eleven guys, he would push so hard that anybody racing with him would think, how does he do what he does? Okay? How does he physically do what he does? And that's what he did in that tour. He pushed beyond everything anyone could imagine, you know, emotionally, psychologically, and physically.
Because it was common knowledge at the time, wasn't it, that Eno had who had won the tour 5 times, as you say, they were teammates. Greg LeMond had been second the year before, and there was this kind of gentleman's agreement between them that Greg would be the sort of the number one in the Lavie-Clair team, the big French team at the time, in 1986. And then sort of midway through the race, it became apparent that deal wasn't being honored quite as quite straight as had perhaps made out earlier, right?
Yeah, and there were all these other things happening in that tour. There was Eno's promise to Greg. Like, loyalty meant a lot to Greg. Greg was a loyal person. And, you know, he wanted to take his teammates' word as such. When it wasn't being carried out, there were all these other things happening almost simultaneously. Okay, like within a matter of days, Pedro Delgado's mom died. Okay, Delgado left the tour. Zimmerman, there were things happening with Zimmy. Okay, like Boifava, his director sportif, and there was like Riff on his team. Okay, so when you're on a team, you're very aware of what's going on with other team leaders because you see the behavior at the team table, and you see the behavior of the staff and the riders. And here was this elegant rider, this amazing, amazing young man. And people were saying not so nice things about him. He had lost weight, and they were like, you know, you lost too much weight and this and that. But he was this gifted climber, this gifted rider, and a very lovely young man. And he moved out of his folks' house. Okay. He moved away from home. He was living by himself. He was training and he lost weight. And he, you know, people were talking about, oh, he's going into ketosis. And, you know, training and going into ketosis so that if that happens to him, if he goes into that state, he'll be okay for a little bit. And so there's all this talk about Zimmy, okay? But he was a gifted climber. And nothing bad happened to him because he lost some weight to climb. And Boifava was all over his case. And he had the most amazing experience in that tour, like almost a spiritual experience in a way that he, for him, that he was there racing with Greg and Eno. Like he was having this other experience. Then there's Coakley, who trained him as an amateur. There's no radios. These guys can't be spoken to in their head, in their ear. All these riders in that tour are it's all perception. They're all racing by their perception, what's happening around them. They can't go, "Well, hold on, I'm going to go back and ask my director what I should do." That hardly happened at all. They're all moving according to what's going on. And so we had Delgado out, Zimmerman having his own upset. Nobody talks about what happened to poor Zimmerman. He had a whole thing going on. And in his mix with Greg and Eno, and then Greg, and then Eno with his knee, and trying to cover up that his knee hurt. Usually when someone's knee hurts, when you're on a team and somebody's knee hurts, you tell, "Hey, I'm having trouble with my knee. I'm gonna have some treatment on my knee. Can you guys help me?" But this was like a big cover-up job. And so that was very difficult to have this happen in-house. And all of that at the same time is all these whispers are happening, and my 7-Eleven guys are trying to hold on, and Greg's coming to the hotel. And all I kept saying was, "I can't wait for the tour to be over, you guys, and we're going to go to Cafe Pacifico and have chips and salsa." And I kept saying when Greg came over, "Greg, what's Cafe Pacifico like?" Okay. And he's like, "Oh, it's kind of Tex-Mex, but it's better than nothing. We'll go get some beers." And it was just something to look forward to.
Because of course Andy Hampstead was on the team as well,
Right.
Greg LeMond's team, and he'd been with 7-Eleven the year before. So you're probably a bit of a sanctuary for those guys, an escape from that drama that was playing out in that team.
Yeah. And I felt my heart went out to Steve Bauer. These boys, and Jean-Francois Bernard, he was a young rider on that team. Everybody on that team so looked up to Bernard Hinault, including Greg. Okay, including Greg, and including so many people in that peloton. I mean, if you wanted to take a piss, you asked Bernard Hinault. If you wanted to go see your family up ahead, you had to ask Hinault. That was such a beautiful part of cycling, Lionel. I loved that. These guys were on steel frames. They were men of steel. They were strong men. And, a lot of us got to experience Bernard Hinault off his bike. We got to see soft sides of him, and that tour showed so many of his little cracks, trying to keep ducking and covering from Greg, as the tour went on. It's like somebody walking with a limp, and then you're like, "Is your leg okay?" "I'm fine. Your head's crooked." And it was just one thing after another. And, Tappy and Paul, and I really felt for the riders on La Vie Claire. And my guys were doing double time in a way, trying to save save themselves from each day. And then, trying to be friends with Greg and support Greg, but they weren't, they didn't have, 15 years of European, strength in their legs to get up there and do something for him, which they would have done in a second if they could. So all that was happening at once.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.